Thank you and good afternoon, members of the panel. Dan Fowler on behalf of Appellant W.O. Danielson Construction Company Limited. With me at council table and on the brief are Brian Widman, immediately to the right of the first chair, a lawyer from my office, and Thomas Dillavu, president and owner of W.O. Danielson Construction. I'm going to reserve 5 minutes, if I can keep my eye on the clock, to respond to cross-appellant's argument. This action was initiated in Arapahoe County District Court as two separate actions originally. And it involved two Douglas County School District projects, as the court knows from the briefing, Stadium Number 3 in Parker and Middle School Number 8 in Castle Rock. It was Danielson who sought consolidation, perhaps as a precursor to some of the issues that have developed in the trial court and are before the court, this court today. Consolidation was actually opposed by Fiore in the court below. The September 23, 2010 order of Judge Christopher Cross, who had the case originally, consolidated the case, noting, among other things, that in his ruling that the subcontracts were identical in the two school cases, including language which allowed a set off from job to job in both cases. The importance of that set off in a mandatory prevailing party fee situation has been lost, we submit, in this case, and that's why we are here. Besides the set-off provision, which appeared in both, we call it the deduct provision in the brief, besides that appearing in both subcontracts contained the identical mandatory prevailing party fee clause, attorney fee and cost clause. After appellant prevailed in the trial court before Judge Hannon in Arapahoe County District Court, we got the trial court, September 24, 2012, findings, conclusions, and orders to the tune of the net award to counterclaiming defendant appellant here of $145,564.35. That was later reduced to a net judgment in favor of Danielson, February 8, 2013, for the same amount. The trial court denied W.O. Danielson's request for attorney's fees and costs. Our appeal is based on the trial court's abuse of discretion and error in law in interpreting and reconciling the contract provisions to come to the conclusion that Danielson was not net prevailing party.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Fowler, what in the contract, and I understand your argument on the deduct provision, nothing in the contract ties the deduct provision to the fee provision, right? They're in different sets, parts of the contract. They don't refer to one another, correct?
That's correct.
Right, so, and I promise you, I understand your argument and that judgment, but I just don't understand why it's necessarily this term, the prevailing party, requires the court to net it out, as opposed to what the court did. I got a number of contracts. You won some issues. If you won some issues, I can't say the party prevailed. Why necessarily does the court have to come to this net judgment conclusion, particularly given that Colorado has never adopted the net judgment?
I don't think the court has to, frankly, Judge. The rule of discretion still applies, but what the trial court has done here is with its conclusion in its own attorney fee order that in effect it erred by concluding that Danielson breached the Stadium 3 contract when in reality it did not. The trial judge has kind of set all of these post-trial and post-judgment proceedings a bit on their ear, and I think the only way that error can be corrected is by a reversal and a remand to the trial court for that determination.
If I can interrupt you again, Mr.
Sure,
Ryan, I apologize. Because I was concerned when I read that in your brief about the court saying it erred, and I looked at that. I looked at it pretty closely. I mean, I guess pose a different way of looking at that, and I want you to react to it. It seemed to me when I read it that the court was saying, yeah, when you look at it, in one way, you won on the breach of the subcontract. He's talking for yours. You guys won. If you look at it a different way, you really didn't win. But it was in the context of denying them fees, as I read it. And again, I'm positing the student. I want you to push back. And so, to me, it's at least possible to read what the court was saying is, yes, you were the prevailing party under the stadium subcontract. But notwithstanding you prevail, I am not going to award you fees because you were not the prevailing party when I look at all the contracts together. And isn't that what the court was saying? Because if it wasn't saying that, wouldn't it have awarded you fees?
I can't find that in your order, particularly if that's what the court is saying.
Okay.
Had the court been only speaking to Fiore, I think Your Honor's interpretation of the order might make some more sense, that indeed, Fiore, if we were only taking this one case in isolation, which coincidentally is how Fiore wanted to proceed with the case initially, two separate actions, but that's not what we got here. And in the attorney fee order that the court is familiar with, in the attorney fee order, it said, considering all three subcontracts, and that's two pertaining to middle school number 8 and one pertaining to the stadium number 3 project, of course, that's not how it plays. Unfortunately, trying to figure out what the trial judge is saying in that order, the only thing we know for sure is that he has previously found, concluded, and ordered that my client was in breach of the Stadium 3 contract. So unless he and judge, the judge below did not see fit to go back and sua sponte amend his findings, conclusions, and orders. To the contrary, he told both parties, a pox on your respective attorney fee houses, there will be no award of attorney fees.
And isn't that totally consistent? And again, what I'm getting to is you've started from the premise that the court, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but essentially the court had conceded and had erred in finding breach of the stadium subcontract. And I guess I'm pushing back a little. I'm not sure we can say that. Because I think the court saying, yeah, you breached the stadium subcontract, but you guys breached it, and you guys breached other stuff, and I'm going to say neither party prevailed. And so what I'm pushing back on some, and I'll shut up here, I apologize, I'm not sure I can accept and persuade me that the court admitted it was wrong to say you all breached the stadium subcontract.
Well, consider the pushback, Judge Gabriel, that you just gave me. You just gave the chambers here in the courtroom. They were considered individually. Contrary to the teachings of the Wheeler T.L. Spencer case, or the Wheeler T.L. Roofing case, and certain of the other prevailing party attorney fee cases, there wasn't an overall look. Anderson versus Purcell is a Supreme Court case that talks about, let's take an overall look at this thing. If we, instead of putting it to 20 people out on the sidewalk, who's the prevailing party here, we keep it within the context of the courtroom, and aren't we really lost in the detail of, is this a cost case or a mandatory, voluntarily entered prevailing party attorney fee clause? That's a big distinction. And then has this trial judge, if he does, as Your Honor suggests, he's looking at it individually and say, you don't get fees because you breached this contract that he now says maybe you didn't breach under the set-off provision. You don't get fees because you lost Fiore in a myriad of ways. Has he really taken the overall look at the overall context look that is so critical to this determination, says the Supreme Court in Anderson versus Purcell? Taking the overall look, Fiore started out with a claim for $186,727 cash money from Danielson, unpaid. You breached our subcontract, you violated the Trust Fund Act, you are guilty of civil theft, Tom Dillaroo personally, along with the corporation, and unjust enrichment for good measure. There was also a claim for, on the stadium job, $114,370. That was a total of $301,000, give or take, that Fiore said it was entitled to. At the end of the day, all of those claims I just rattled off on the middle school project were dismissed. At the end of the day, Danielson was awarded $145,564. From an overall context standpoint, it is beyond cavil that the prevailing party was W.O. Danielson with a $445,608 swing between what Fiore came to court wanting and what Danielson left with.
And didn't Danielson ask for like $800,000 and you ended up with just $145,000?
That was reduced voluntarily before trial started to $600,000. And then you're right, we lost some of the points as well at trial. But in terms of net prevailing party, the court's findings, conclusions, and order as they stand are quite clear. And the only loss, so to say, that seems to have influenced the court's thinking on the attorney fee award was the stadium fee breach that is still part of the order. But we did start out at a higher number. With that, I'm going to reserve my remaining 4 minutes.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Josh Fugas. I'm with the law firm Lewis Rocha Rothgerber. With me at counsel table is Mr. Larry Fiore of Fiore & Sons. Your Honors, what I would like to do is address two principal issues to the extent I can. If there's time left, I will address the remaining issues in the brief. First and foremost, I want to address Fiore & Sons' appeal of the trial court's interpretation of the relevant contractual documents. Next, I want to move to W.O. Danielson's request that the court overturn the trial court's prevailing party analysis. Very briefly on the facts, the material facts to Fiore's appeal here are that at Danielson's direction, Fiore entered or submitted an initial bid for work to remove a base estimate of 5,100 cubic yards of rock. The parties knew and understood there were more than 5,100 cubic yards of rock. After it became apparent that the volume far exceeded 5,100, Fiore and Sons entered into a written agreement with Danielson that explicitly provided for the amount that Fiore and Sons would be compensated per cubic yard of rock and a determination of how to tabulate the volume of rock removed from the site. And this is Exhibit 54 that is cited repeatedly throughout both parties' briefs. Fiore and Sons performed the work. There's no dispute regarding that. Danielson paid Fiore for the work, minus the retainage that it held. After, and only after, the project's owner refused to pay Danielson on those same terms that Danielson had agreed to pay Fiore, then and only then did Danielson turn around and inform Fiore that it did not need to pay Fiore before it had overpaid, in fact, Fiore, because the owner had not compensated Danielson, and therefore Danielson did not need to compensate Fiore.
Look, if I can interrupt you here, Mr. Fugas.
Certainly.
What do you do with the, I think the parties call it a flow-through provision, if I remember. There's this language that basically said we'll correct it all at the end of the day, any corrections that need to be made. So two things. In the September 2006 letters, I mean, the letter from Danielson did say total amount paid TBD, which would suggest to be determined. And then there was this flow-through provision. I couldn't put my finger on it right this second, but essentially says, you know, at the end of the day, when contract closed out, we'll make any corrections that need to be made. I understand very much your argument that the trial court construed this as a pay-if-paid clause. But the court never says any word about pay-if-paid. What the court does is cite that flow-through provision and said, I'm going to look at the cubic yards and the truckloads as kind of the estimate to be, you know, fixed or corrected or figured out at the end of the day. And then, and so I guess, what's wrong with that?
Absolutely.
Tell me.
I will explain to you. Number one, you are correct. The trial court never used the terms pay if paid. However, the net effect of the trial court's interpretation is to impose to insert a valid pay if paid provision into these contractual agreements where none exist. And to address your two points, number one, the September 2006 letters, it does say that the final amount to be determined. That, of course, is because it was impossible to determine the final amount until you knew how much rock was removed from the site. And the parties agreed they would count at 22 cubic yards per truck. So it was intentional that was left blank. Number two, the flow-through provision, and it's in Exhibit 421-138, it's Section 50.03. And at that is a provision that is found in the agreement between the project's owner, the school district, and Danielson. And that provides that all prior requests for payment shall be subject to correction in the final request for payment. And we have no dispute that that provision, as others in that contract between the owner and Danielson, generally flows through to the subcontracts between Danielson and Fiore, but it does not in this case. And here's why. Paragraph 4.5 of the subcontract provides, quote, if the work for which Fiore claims extra compensation is determined by the owner or architect not to entitle Danielson to a change order or extra compensation, then Danielson shall not be liable to Fiore for any extra compensation for such work, comma, unless Danielson agreed in writing to such extra compensation. And that writing to such extra compensation is exactly what Exhibit 54 is. And that is why the flow down provision does not apply to the agreement regarding the rock removal, the 606 per cubic yard that was later reduced to 557 per agreement.
And forgive me, because I just don't remember, Mr. Burgos, did the trial court make a finding about that provision? Was it argued expressly to the trial court?
There's no express finding by the trial court regarding the impact of subparagraph 4.5. However, that argument is consistent with Fiore's argument throughout the entire case, and that is that they had an agreement with Danielson to remove the rock, and they needed to be paid under that agreement, i.e. Exhibit 54.
Would that be a factual question as to whether it applied, or a legal question?
I believe it's a legal question because it's the interpretation, it's the interplay, the relationship between the agreements, between all layers of agreements in this case.
Maybe I wasn't clear. The issue of whether Danielson agreed in writing to such extra compensation, that would be a fact question, wouldn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
Right. Yeah. And my memory is the same as yours. I don't think the court made a finding, but isn't there an implicit finding that the court rejected that? You're right. For the whole agreement, you said, we have an agreement. And the court at least implicitly rejected that you had such an agreement.
I apologize, Your Honor. I do believe there is a finding by the court in the findings, conclusions, and order. And in that, the court discusses the Exhibit 54, and it discusses that, and then calculates the payment based off the 557, but bases the amount of the payment on how much the survey showed of rock removal.
Right, because you're right. Because the court, as I remember it, said this was just a preliminary kind of estimate of how much it was, but the court basically said it's okay to have done the calculation with the engineers. So don't we have a rejection, maybe even explicitly, of the argument that there was an agreement that Danielson agreed in writing to the extra compensation along the lines that you said? The court rejected the argument that we're going to measure it by the 22 cubic feet per truckload.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the trial court never gave proper attention to the effect of paragraph 4.5 in the subparagraphs. The court took Exhibit 54 and interpreted that as, I'm not quite sure, but that the flow-down provision 50.03 of the larger contract, the trial court took that as that was always in play, and it wasn't. A de novo review of Exhibit 54, I believe, shows that this is a separate agreement by which the parties agreed on this specific issue, and Exhibit 54 then cuts off the flow-down. With respect to this additional rock removal, Fiore and Danielson had an agreement with one another. It was clear, it's unambiguous. With respect to the same issue, Danielson and the project's owner had an agreement. Those are separate agreements. And I think the trial court missed that in the analysis.
Why isn't to be determined inherently ambiguous? Could be, you have to count the trucks as they go off the site. It could be that you're going to reassess the quantity at the end of the project, which in the trial court apparently adopted the latter interpretation.
I believe it's not ambiguous because the agreement, in the same agreement that says TBD, to be determined, it sets forth the amount that will be paid per cubic yard and the method for calculating. And therefore, to inject any other method for calculating it misconstrues the document and it does not give it the proper interpretation. That the plain and unambiguous language, the TBD, I don't think needs to be interpreted. That could have been left a line, and you just write a number in at the end of the project. once you multiply the number of trucks by the price per cubic yard.
Okay.
And I don't mean to skip around on you, but I also want to address as briefly as I can Danielson's request for attorney's fees. I think it's clear that that judgment rule has not been adopted in Colorado. I know Judge Webb's 2004 Colorado Lawyer article, to quote it, says that the Spencer decision, which is relied upon so heavily by Danielson in its briefing, quote, it acknowledged but did not mandate application of the net judgment rule. And I do not want to bore you with what I believe you all already know in that respect. Danielson then goes on to cite two cases decided subsequent to Spencer in which I believe are advocating for an adoption of the net judgment rule in this case, and one is Wheeler. However, in Wheeler, division of this court explicitly recognized that the Supreme Court of Colorado has never adopted the net judgment rule. And Wheeler Court also said, in a quote, in a proper case, the trial court may rule that neither party prevailed and award no fees. This is exactly that type of proper case. If we look at it, we have two cases, Mr. Fowler mentioned, we had two cases that were consolidated. We have three different contracts. So we have 10 affirmative claims for relief. We have two counterclaims. We have 12 affirmative defenses and setoffs, so related to 12 different discrete construction issues. There's no doubt Danielson prevailed on some. There's no doubt Fiore prevailed on others. The trial court, as is repeatedly stated in Colorado law, is in a unique position to, in multi-claim cases such as this, the trial court is in a unique position to determine which party, if any, prevails. Judge Hannon's decision that there was no prevailing party in this respect is not an abuse of discretion, and we ask that that decision not be overturned.
Counsel, let me ask you, and I'm sure neither side wants to hear this, but if we were hypothetically to simply affirm the trial court's judgment, should either side get attorney's fees on appeal?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. If this panel affirms the judgment in all respects of the trial court, I do not believe that attorney's fees on appeal are appropriate in this matter. I would also like to, if I can, address Danielson's argument that the deduct provision somehow insulates it or immunizes it from breaching any agreement with Fiore. As Mr. Fowler stood up here, what they have called the deduct provision, we have called the set-off provision. I believe you call it the set-off provision as well. And that's what it is. It's a set-off. And a set-off is when one party is owed money by the other, they can set off the amount that they owe to that party. It is not an insulation from liability for breach of contract. That is, Fiore had to prove all four elements of breach of contract. The court found that the evidence, upon the preponderance of evidence, that Fiore had proved those four claims. Now, when it comes to figuring out who's writing the check where at the end of the day, that's when the deduct provision becomes relevant, and that's when that needs to be addressed.
But, I mean, it seems counterintuitive to me to say that Danielson breaches because it owed Fiore about $38,000 and didn't pay it, but oh, by the way, Fiore owes Danielson $145,000. Seems to me that's a little more, because it's intrinsic to the contract, that seems to be a little more complex than the common law or Rule 13 component of a set-off, whereas if you're sued, you can seek to set off your liability, as opposed to the contract seems to contemplate a net judgment type of process.
I think you're exactly correct, Your Honor, that it is a little more complex than the traditional common law set-off. However, if we take Danielson's argument to its logical end, and that is a party who alleges it is owed money by another party, that party, if Danielson is correct, the party who is alleging they're owed money would be free to breach. Because according to Danielson, and in their argument, they are insulated from liability for breach. And if we think about this in the context of a bank or a promissory note, a deed of trust, if someone misses their payment 1 month, they are in default of the loan obligation. And then if the bank is now has a license to breach, whatever that may be, it may seem extreme, but I can't see how that is reconciled with the idea that courts do not encourage parties to breach contractual agreements. So if I have a contract, anytime I feel the person on the other side of the contract owes me money, I then have some kind of an immunity to breach agreements with him. That just doesn't, I don't see how that it complies with Colorado law.
Okay. Yeah, while you're looking around there, Mr.
Yes, sir. Rubis,
let me ask you a question. This, the argument you make about determined in the field, where exactly was that raised in the trial court?
I think that is raised, once again, perhaps those exact words are not used, but as we all know, there's no talismanic language to preserve an issue for appeal. The determination of the volume of rock was a central issue in this dispute. I don't think anyone will stand up here and podium and say it wasn't. And the idea of interpreting, the court had to, at some point, read that language and interpret it to see whether it was the survey that was conducted or whether it was the truckload. So while that issue may not appear in those exact words, the sum and substance of that argument and that issue appear throughout the record in this case.
Well, let me push back. I mean, the issue of how you figure out how much rock was clearly an issue throughout this trial. But where's the question of it's not good enough, it wasn't determined in the field? I have to tell you, I looked. I didn't see it.
I agree, Sten, Your Honor, but I do believe in our proposed findings, where in Fiore's proposed findings, where they seek to have the trial court and interpret that phrase to only allow the truckload count, I think is the sum and substance of that argument and is adequately preserved.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But I had 409, and that's what I was planning for, but it says 407 on the clock, so I'll finish my argument.
Talk fast.
None of the issues have been preserved in appeal that counsel raises on the cross appeal. The pay if paid, well-known legal lingo in the construction arena, it never occurred in the courthouse. So it's an interesting spin on what the trial court did. But the fact of the matter is, all of the Douglas County contract documents were incorporated by reference into Exhibits 1, 30, and 31, the three subcontracts that were entered between the parties. For Fiore to assert in the trial court and here that it could rewrite, in effect, the payment specification, I think is what we called it in our brief, is a bit off the hook. The Exhibit 54 letter was an agreement on unit price, $6.06 per cubic yard, which was eventually reduced by Fiore as an accommodation, apparently, to Danielson to $5.75 per cubic yard. But until there was a determination in the field by measurement, which is what the provision goes on to say, the parties couldn't know what the final reconciliation was.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mr. Fowler.
Yes,
the language in your letter accepting their proposal was, your proposed method of tracking the material is acceptable, excluding one item, which is stockpiling versus something else.
Mm-hmm.
It does then, I recognize what you just said, and I raised, it does say to be determined. What does that language mean? Your proposed method of tracking the material is acceptable.
In a large civil project, the excavator is entitled to be paid on a periodic basis, just like every subcontractor. If the excavation of rock goes on and on and on, as it seemed to under middle school number 8, clearly the subcontractor cannot, the excavation subcontractor cannot be held to that final 50.04 or whatever it was, payment specification. They've got to be paid somehow as things go along. That's what tracking meant. Our expert Gary Martin, PE of Martin Engineers, testified at some length about custom in the industry, and that while an inefficient and inaccurate method of tracking, the this truck holds so many cubic yards method is a rough way to keep paying the excavator as the work goes on, subject always to reconciliation at the end of the job based on what the actual measured in the field amounts are.
Council, was there anything in the record, I mean, anything in the contract documents that authorized the particular method of calculation that was used by, I think it was JVA, the people who made the calculation you're relying on?
Yeah, JVA was a civil engineer that took the Zylstra-Baker survey results and then made the calculation. I think it's the provision of the Douglas County School District specifications that tells us as much as we were ever going to know about the measurement method. Nobody says exactly how, but Thomas specified that when you talk about measurement of a hole, which is in effect what they were doing, you started out with the unexcavated ground level. The excavation is, yeah, that survey. The excavation occurs. The same surveyors go back in and survey the bottom of the hole. And that's how you figure out your measured quantity in civil work such as this. And do they say that in even shorter words than the way I just explained it? No, they simply refer to it as the measured in field. I think my time's up.
It is.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments from both counsel. The case stands submitted. The court will issue a written opinion in due course.